Welcome to the Seamus Heaney Centre podcast. In this episode, Stephen Sexton talks to Wayne Miller, poet and former Fulbright scholar at the Seamus Heaney Centre, about his new book, We the Jury.
Hi, Wayne. Thank you very much for joining us ahead of the publication of your new book, We the Jury. Your previous book, Post, was published in 2016. A lot has happened in those years. Was the composition of We the Jury typical of how you've put together books of poems in the past?
Yes, more than no. I think that what I tend to do with a book of poems, what I've done with my last couple of books, is I write without thinking about where I'm going. You know, so I'm just writing poems. And when I hit about 30 pages, I print them out and put them all together and just kind of look at them and see what's there. And if it feels like there's any kind of coherency, if poems seem to talk to each other, if I can find thematic connections, you know, and then I start to what I call write into the book, which, you know, so I might, for instance, with this book, there are two long poems in it on progress and on history. I'd written on progress. And when I looked at my poems that were all together, I thought to myself, I need another poem like that to sort of justify the inclusion of this, you know, long five-page poem. I think it's five pages. Something to balance its weight, because so many of the other poems in the book at the time were fairly short. And that was the other thing, is I felt like maybe it needed some longer poems. And I started taking, I'm an ongoing sort of notebook writer. I'm always filling tiny little notebooks that I keep in my pockets. Periodically, I transcribe them into Word files on my computer. And I also, this book has several poems that are in multiple sort of short sections and that are disconnected a little bit, that are kind of built around an image, say the idea of rain. You know, I realized that I had a bunch of these things in these notebooks. I had a bunch of small lyric poems. I had this one really big poem. And so I decided I needed another big poem. I needed some things to sort of round out the way the book felt. But I will also say this book was different in others from others in that it seemed more coherent at the outset. Its themes were pretty established already. I didn't have to pull things closer together as I was writing into it. It seemed like the kind of arc of the book was there. I needed to more sort of formally fill out the kinds of poems that were in it, if that makes sense.
It does entirely. And did the, out of interest, did the title come towards the end, or had it been with you for some time through that thinking?
It was around that time that I was starting to, you know, think about pulling the book together when I got called for jury duty here in Denver. Okay. I was sitting in, I was one of the lucky people who, I mean, I only got called once into a courtroom and was quickly dismissed. But I spent most of the day just sitting in the kind of atrium of the court building with all the other potential jurors waiting to be called in to be voir dired. And that's when I wrote the title poem. And immediately as I wrote it, I thought, this is a good title poem.
It is. I mean, it's got a lot of echoes, I guess. I can't. I mean, I hear "we the people," I guess, behind it, which I suppose is a similar thing. So you didn't go to, you didn't have a case as such. You were there.
Yeah, I didn't do anything with any real court proceeding at all. I wasn't even really questioned in the voir dire. I was one of the people who was like the alternate to be pulled into the box if other people were dismissed. And then eventually they made their jury and they dismissed all of the alternates. And I guess that qualified as us having done what we needed to do and we were allowed to leave.
Well, I had to do it once. I guess you used your time more productively than me. I actually watched, let's call a legally downloaded copy of 12 Angry Men in the waiting room. I thought that was, I don't know what I was doing. I guess the idea of being caught was everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sure. Let me ask a little bit about the cover, if that's okay. So it's a photograph by Danny Singer. It's an incredible image. So big sky. Very big sky, small town, And I noticed, you know, if you'll forgive it, I guess there's a couple of sonnets in the book too. But there is a kind of golden ratio to the image, which I guess is kind of compelling. And Midwest-esque, which I wonder if that's a word. I guess it's a nice word. It feels like the Midwest, but I don't think it's the Midwest. Is that right?
Yes, he's Canadian. And I don't know if Canadians call it this because I've only ever been to Vancouver, but I suspect it's the Canadian Midwest, if that's the right term.
Sure. How did you arrive at this image? Are you pretty familiar with Danny Singer's work?
So I think it was about 2016, 2017. My son was pretty young at the time. And I remember, at that age, he must have been 2016. He was like 1.5, 2. I can't remember exactly when it was, but he was born in 2015. So he was 1.5 or 2, I guess. And I would take him to the Denver Art Museum and, try to see a show, like one exhibit, before he would get bored of, sitting in his stroller and putting up with me just looking at things quietly. And then there's a huge, like, sort of kids area where they have various activities for kids and things that you can do. It's a very family friendly museum. And Danny Singer had a very small show there. It was not really featured. It was just almost like an adjunct to a larger show. And his show was about main streets and these kind of big sky main streets that he was doing. They weren't all this kind of big sky format, but apparently they're very hard for him to make, or very complicated. I don't know if hard is the right term, but they're seamlessly sort of put together from multiple images digitally. He sets up multiple cameras and takes this whole main street. And then you get this sort of false effect of feeling like you're really far back from the main street, when in fact the photograph was taken just standing on the other side of the street, but with so many cameras that it spreads it out in this way. Which I think is just fascinating, to make something in a very complicated digital process, and the effect is that it's not complicated at all, that it's simple and straightforward. And I love that idea. And I'm originally from the Midwest, though not that far west. I'm from Cincinnati, Ohio, which is actually a city that's sort of debated as to where you put it. Is it Midwest? Is it sort of more Eastern? Is it Southern? Because it's right on the Mason-Dixon line, but it's still in Ohio. So it's a sort of contested space. I lived for 12 years in Missouri, where I taught at the University of Central Missouri. And then I moved out here to Denver, which is on the edge of the mountains, but we're still on the plain. I mean, Denver is flat as a pancake. And in fact, I believe it's the town of Ceylon in Canada that cover image is of, and that's due north of Denver, right across the Canadian line. So I'm rambling about it, but I just love the image. I thought it was fascinating how he was able to do this complicated stuff and make it seem simple. And I also just loved the smallness of the human space in it. So much of the image's sky, but it's so whited out that you can't even tell that it's sky until you really look. And I thought that on the cover of a book called We the Jury, which clearly couldn't have like a gavel or a courtroom on the cover, that would absolutely kill the title. We needed something that could show what sort of human smallness, a kind of humility about who we are, to push back against this idea that we're constantly making judgments about ourselves and the world around us, which is one of the things that the book is thinking about.
I remember you've said, I think about an earlier book, This City, Our City, that it was imagining not really any particular city, but maybe aspects of the city or many cities arriving in one kind of place, or the qualities of the city or experiences of the city. Does We the Jury, does it take place in anywhere in particular, or are you a little more connected to real places, whatever they are?
So when I was writing The City, Our City, I was writing that I started writing the poems in that during the Bush administration. And there was so much kind of American exceptionalism in the rhetoric of the Bush administration, but also in the sort of counter rhetoric of the left. You know, if the right was sort of envisioning the United States as the kind of exceptional city on the hill, The left would also often do this sort of, we're exceptionally terrible, you know, we have done terrible things in the world. And I kept thinking about the fact that both of these ideas seemed a little bit inflated and ridiculous to me. Sure, since World War II, the United States has had inordinate power in the world. But I also think that what you see in American history is what you see in human history, you know, goodness and badness. And, you know, it didn't seem exceptional to me at all. And if anything, I felt like the history of or the what you saw in American politics at the time, which was has now completely come to be a staunch division between city and rural America, that to me just looked like Europe. That looked like the Spanish Civil War. That looked like the French Revolution. And I thought that the way that we were talking about it here seemed a little ridiculous. So that book was kind of all about trying to, for me, think about American culture and contemporary history in a global context and to cut against exceptionalist ideas. But as a result, that book doesn't feel very American at all. I certainly haven't lived in every city in the world, but I was sort of drawing on the history of the cities that I have lived in. And so there's some Madrid in that book. There's some New York City. There's some Houston, Texas. There's some Cincinnati, Ohio. My dad lived in Anchorage, Alaska for a while. There's some Alaska. There's some Kansas City. So that was the idea of that book. This book, With the History, is, I think, a very consciously American book. I have Stages on a Journey Westward, which is a title that I'm completely ripping off from a James Wright poem, or maybe just nodding to. There are a lot of little moments, at least for my amusement in this book, where I'm nodding to poems by poets I really like. That poem is trying to play around with the idea of American westward expansion and manifest destiny. There's just a lot of Americanness in this book, I think. I'm trying to think about America right now.
Thank you. Would you read a poem for us, Wayne? We'd love to hear one.
Sure. I thought I would start with this poem that you would express some interest in, Meeting the Board. This is a poem that is set in Missouri. And in fact, I thought this would be a good one to read because before I came to Belfast for the Fulbright, that was the only time ever that at the University of Central Missouri, two faculty members had gotten Fulbrights in the same year. It was me and a math professor. And so the president of the university decided to have a kind of celebratory dinner at his house. And the president was a perfectly nice guy, but there were all of these board members who showed up, and it struck me immediately upon arriving how anti-intellectual the board members were, the vast majority of them, not all of them, but many of them, and just how much we were, you know, in our little ivory tower, sitting actually sort of in the cradle of American history. We're in this antebellum house in a slave state. All of the servers who had been hired by the president and the board to serve the food at this were all Black. And that was very uncomfortable because I think almost everyone at the dinner was all white. And in this antebellum house, it just felt like some sort of strange and think about the way in which, you know, poets have decided that we would like to have a middle-class life, so we're very comfortable having sort of jobs that actually pay money in the academy. And at the same time, I think there's a kind of compromise that goes with that, because I think the academy, not everywhere, but in a lot of places, is undergirded by a lot of things that the academy wouldn't like, if that makes sense. So this poem is about that. This is called Meeting the Board. It was a beautiful antebellum house. The servers were Black students of the university. The silver was out and gibbous. All of this is true. One board member advised me in passing that a teenage daughter shouldn't work. She'd learn from her coworkers criminal things. Instead, she should play soccer. The chairman told us of his dream to gather the faculty in the conference center for a day of unified prayer. Our conversation turned briefly to the poor trapped inside the hurricane, which flashed its lightning into different cities at different times. Those people are never prepared, explained a board member's coiffed wife. The occasion was to mark a recent departmental success that no one expected the board to find interesting. The room was a capsule of their power they were obliged to inhabit before departing for their sealed and, I assume, magnificent box seats above the stadium. For that hour, their approval engulfed us like kudzu. They admired our work, they said, and understanding the balance required of their position, not to mention the impotence of literature. If they read it, they would probably admire this poem.
Earlier, you mentioned some of the longer poems in small sections about rain, which certainly feels like something that might come from a little notebook in your pocket. But it also struck me that that poem reminds me of another one of your poems that ends with extremely memorable line. I remember you reading it in Belfast. I think the last line is "And a watermelon is full of rain." Which I think was also another poem that has a lot of rain in it, in my memory, but maybe I've mixed that up.
No, it is, and it's another notebooky kind of poem.
Yeah. I'm sort of feeling, I'm echoes of all kinds of things that I hear in these poems, occasionally of yourself, which is always welcome, I think. I wanted to ask another thing. So Jericho Brown calls these poems love poems. Maybe not that one necessarily. How do you feel about thinking of this book as a book of love poems? Does that feel right?
It's funny, when that blurb for the book came in, I was really struck by it because I had never thought of these poems as love poems. But I think Jericho's right. I think that, I think that a lot of the book is trying to figure out how to accept and live with things that I don't always like and how to sort of navigate that kind of complication. And I think that that idea of simultaneously disliking something and accepting it is something we do with people we love, right? And with places we love, that's sort of the nature of love, is that, maybe in the short term, everything seems perfect, but, real love, born out over time is complicated and requires, compromises and difficulties and navigations and all sorts of stuff. And so I think that he's right, actually. And I really like that idea. And I think also, looking at this book now, I think a lot of the poems are, as Jericho described them, sort of a little internalized and a little bit intimate. I'm trying to say things I'm not always comfortable with, and that requires a certain amount of intimacy too. And so maybe that's the other thing that's making him see them as love poems, is that there's a kind of intimate disclosure or something like that. Does that make sense?
It does, yeah. And there are different kinds of intimacy, I guess, all throughout the book. I mean, there is the kind of personal intimacy that's very close to the love poem, which I absolutely see. There's an intimacy to the jury to some extent, and I know that's not necessarily a recurring image, but it creates a feeling in it. And I'm particularly reading the book at the minute, it seems strange but utterly compelling to think that it feels like a book that I want to be reading at this moment. And I suppose that I say that because one of the things that I feel I've noticed very much about the predicament that we're in, and I don't mean to date our conversation so much, but I guess I've noticed that if we've learned anything from a pandemic, from the lockdown experience, it seems that it's about how people see themselves in relation to each other, as you know, in society, whether or not people see themselves as a lot of individuals moving through the world on their own, or if they see themselves as having a certain kind of responsibility to each other. And, you know, I think that We the Jury, in its title, you know, it suggests, you know, both collectiveness and individuality, that the jurors make up the jury, so to speak. And you have an epigraph, too, from Luigi Pirandello that says, my drama lies entirely in my being conscious that each one of us believes himself to be a single person, but that's not true. Is that kind of civic responsibility a part of your thinking in this book?
It is, for sure. And that Pirandello quote is a little bit of a trick, because I think that if you read it, it sounds like that's the clear thing that it's saying. And I think it is talking about the idea that we are all interconnected, and, you know, we are not just individuals operating in a vacuum. But if you know Six Characters in Search of an Author, which is the play that quote is from, the father, who's the character who speaks that line, who is kind of a suspicious character, is really, I mean, when I used to teach that play, I used to teach that line as Pirandello arguing with Dante, because, you know, if Dante is sort of, you know, the towering figure of Italian literature, what is Dante known for in the Divine Comedy? These, you know, one thing that these people have done in their lives becomes the entire depiction of them, and they are forever punished in hell or rewarded or purgatoried for basically one narrative detail of their entire lives. And the father in Pirandello is, he's been caught. He's been visiting this brothel, and it turns out his stepdaughter has come through a separate chain of events to work at that brothel. And he shows up, is put into a room with her, realizes it's his stepdaughter, seems sort of horrified, but the stepdaughter thinks that's what he's always wanted. And Pirandello, I think quite rightly, doesn't, at least in my reading, doesn't resolve that for us. We don't know if that's what he wanted or not. Rather, we get this big speech from the father who says, you know, you're trying to turn my entire life into this one thing, but that's just one small part of my life. You know, we're not just one person. And I like that quote. I use that quote as an epigraph because I like the idea of both the interconnectedness of people being a possible reading of it, and also the idea that within ourselves, we are multiple versions of ourselves and very hard to pin down as any one thing. And I'm suspicious of pinning people down as simply one thing. And if the book is often thinking and trying to complicate the kinds of judgments that we make while still acknowledging that we need to make them, you know, I think that is, for me, an important idea. And I feel like Pirandello kind of gets at that in that play.
And I think that's especially evident, that concern. I mean, dilemma is a word that's used of these poems, and that feels right. But maybe perhaps most evidently in two of those long poems, On Progress, On History, those seem to be exactly trying to understand that of you know, one element of a person's life or their narrative, you know, I guess, you know, marking them. And I think the poems try to look around those, try to aim for a more holistic approach to a person's life rather than one event. I mean, is that fair, do you think?
Yeah, I think it is. Those are the two poems where I'm most overtly thinking about that. And those are also places where I'm trying to connect the narratives of my personal life up with larger narratives. So in On Progress, I'm thinking about the last execution in American history, which was a complete shit show, if I can say that on this podcast. It was just a horrific event. And it turns out that my grandmother attended it. And so, you know, on the one hand, I have a personal family narrative there. And on the other hand, there's a well-known public narrative about why the United States stopped holding public executions. The other, On History, is a little bit less overtly public, but it is about a murder that took place and the fact that the murderer was my dad's good friend when I was growing up.
Would you read one of those poems?
Yeah, I'm going to read on history. And this is a little longer, so bear with me. It's in several sections. On history. I'm trying to think if I need to do anything to set up this poem. Mainly, I just need to tell you that this is in Houston, Texas, which is where, for a while, my father lived when I was growing up after my parents divorced. And the thing that I say in here about Salman Rushdie giving a reading on September 10th, 2001 in Houston is entirely true. On history. One. In December 1961, George Trabing shot Winifred Jean Whitaker and left her body beside the Trinity River in one of the long twin shadows of the I-10 overpass. In August 1988, George Trabing took me out on Trinity Bay in his 25-foot sloop and taught me how to sail. Past the bridge, he cut the engine, and I felt us lock suddenly into the wind dragging overhead, invisible, unrelenting machine. Two. Trabing was in a, quote, narcotics-fueled frenzy when he murdered Whitaker while searching for more drugs, quote, on the Negro side of town, when he attempted to assault a 14-year-old girl then returned her home, when he burglarized a house in wealthy River Oaks for $7. In the subsequent trial, which lasted 3 months, the prosecutor sought the death penalty but did not succeed. Three. The Trinity River enters Trinity Bay by way of the Anahuac Channel, which was cut through the Marshpock Delta by the Army Corps of Engineers, and on the map looks like a straw thrust into the bay's broad bladder. Those afternoons George took me sailing, I don't believe we ever went over to that other side of the bay. Four. He drank cans of beer from a plastic cooler, I drank 7-Up. He taught me to tie knots and watch the mainsail for luffing. Those afternoons were a favor to my father, who still had to work while I was visiting from Ohio. George, who'd become a professor after 15 years in prison, had his summers off. Five. Trabing was finally arrested in the lobby of the Auditorium Hotel, which I'm shocked to discover became the Lancaster, and where on September 10th, 2001, I had drinks after seeing Salman Rushdie read. The event was picketed by fundamentalists. Police barricades maintained a channel through the crowd. I don't remember what Rushdie read or anything he said. I remember passing through that compacted organ of anger and into the vast theater, red and plush and radiant with money. The protesters remained outside, and Rushdie was the only person facing their direction as he spoke. And of course, it was September 10th, 2001. Six. The family of Winifred Jean Whitaker must despise George Trabing, who is surely both abstract and the very most powerful expression of real. They would be right to say it was a racist travesty of justice he became a professor and remained for the rest of his life in Houston, their town, walking free with his title and the prestige it carried. They must find it horrific he could spend 20 years running a master's program for prisoners, that he had the means and time to own a boat and teach a boy to sail. Seven. My God, why did my father let George Trabing take me out alone on his boat? To show friendship, to offer trust? As a teenager, my father had wanted to be a priest, though by 1988 he'd long become an unshakable atheist. I know George was his good friend, and no doubt Dad thought I would enjoy sailing. Beyond that, it was a religious decision, an atavism, a proof of faith. I'm pretty sure. Eight, dare I say, of the men I spent time with as a child, George was among the very kindest and most generous, and he offered me a respectfulness I didn't at 12 deserve. I sometimes flip through the Royal Sailing Illustrated he gave me, and I recall his insistence that a sloop rolled by the wind would quickly right itself. Surely he said that only to allay my fear when the boat heeled hard and I yelped, thinking we were going over. He is to me both an abstraction and a very powerful expression of real, which is why I'm still here in the library so late in the afternoon, retrieving articles from 1961 to 62 on George Trabing. Thank you.
because there's so much of history and there's so much of the future throughout all of these poems. Is that idea of a thread, a kind of narrative thread, interesting?
It is. And I also think that in both of those poems, a lot of irony around that idea. I mean, George Trabean doesn't, I mean, he sort of gets what he deserves in that he goes to prison, but he doesn't get what he deserves in that certainly taking someone's life, you could argue, you should not be able to live well on the other side of that, you know? Maybe you should. I don't know what the right answer is. That's really what I'm trying to do in both of these poems, is I'm trying to write my way into places where I really don't know the answer. You know, as Yeats says, the poems arise out of the arguments with ourselves. Like, I could go back and forth with myself all day about what George Trabean's life ultimately means. And I don't know, you know, I really don't know the answer. I know that for me, he was a very important person who was very kind to me. And I also know that he's a monster to other people. And, you know, probably both of those things are very true, and that they can be true. I think that in On Progress, there's also a kind of uncertainty there. I mean, just the fact that the grandmother in that poem, my grandmother, was, you know, an unapologetic racist who was fairly happy to have witnessed this guy's execution. She was certainly not someone who later in life repented that in some way, as that racist line that she says indicates. But then also, she was herself a victim of prejudice. She, in a small town in the South, married this is going to sound resonant and given the history of Northern Ireland, but it's also a thing, particularly in the South in America. She was a Protestant who married a Catholic, and they had to elope because of that. You know, she was very mentally ill for much of her life. She lived a very difficult life. You know, and she was also kind of sweet and gentle. And, you know, what do you do with all of those things at once? They're not really reconcilable. And for me, that's sort of the point.
It feels like that. And I guess when I was thinking about these poems and thinking about the dilemmas and these problems that, you know, they're much more real than thought experiments or anything like that. But they, you know, they feel like deliberations. That's a word that I felt when I was reading through these poems, not necessarily in the same poem, but, you know, the thoughtfulness that I certainly associate with your poems in general, but in a really clear way here, this sense of like the mind trying to weigh things up. And one of the things that I noticed through some of the poems, I think, and especially as it gets on, it feels almost that there's something of a cost for all this deliberation, you know, that there is, you know, the act of retelling the story the way, let's say, a jury might go over and over things together to tell the story over again, to try to understand it. You know, I guess the hope is that by saying it again, you will understand something more of it, which seems to be one of the effects here. But it does feel like the act of retelling the story, it seems like it, you know, it has a cost too. It seems that by re-inhabiting some of these things, that there's a kind of risk of re-traumatizing or certainly traumatizing again anyway. Does that feel right? Do you feel there is a cost for deliberating, that it's not divorced from the real world? It's not abstract. It is real too.
I mean, that's certainly a fair concern. But I also think that the alternative of sort of not allowing ourselves to retell the stories and reconsider where we can stand in relationship to them and reconsider them in their full complexity, I think that also is a risk. I think it cuts against our ability to understand ourselves as humans. And so, you know, I think this is why these questions are very hard. Like, you know, I mean, one of the nice things about poetry is that no one reads it, so I probably don't have to worry about Winifred Jean Whittaker's family reading this poem or George Trabean's children reading this poem. I think he only has a daughter, and the odds that that they would encounter this are very limited. But I also, when I published this poem and when I published On Progress, I thought a lot about those questions. I did think about, you know, let's say George Trabean's daughter did read this poem. Let's say Winifred Jean Whittaker's family did read this poem, do I think that I've been fair to their version or to their position within the narrative? And I hope that I have been. I can't speak for them, but I hope that I have been. I did think about that when I was writing these.
Maybe I could ask just one other question that maybe, I mean, I don't know what the answer to this is, of course, and it might not be easily answerable. But it's quite complex, I think, in all, you know, certainly in poems, in, you know, in films, in culture of all kinds. I wonder what the appetite is, do you feel, for this kind of complexity? I mean, it seems that, you know, that's something that a lot of people are maybe not frightened of, but, you know, it's difficult. A lot of people don't really want difficulty. I mean, is that something you feel? Do you feel as though there's any risk, not with the complexity of the poem, say, but the complexity of the idea? I mean, there isn't an easy resolution to any of these things. Do you feel that's a conversation that we should have more often?
I mean, I think we're in a moment where a lot of people are not excited about wrangling with really indeterminate ideas and situations, because I think that the sort of larger structure of the world we're living in, with sort of growing, populist autocratic governments, you know, you have a very fraught world right now. And I think a lot of people are rightly wary of overly indulging a lot of uncertainty when there are things that they think require action in the world, and we need to be moving the world in directions that they believe in. But I also, to me, that's the importance and the value of poetry, is that it is, it's an intimate art form. It is a quiet art form. It's ironic that I'm saying this right after an American poet read at the Super Bowl. But, you know, generally, it is an intimate, quiet art form. It's an art form where, you know, you have one mind speaking to another and trying to figure things out, at least in the version of poetry that I'm most drawn to. And so I figure that if we can't be doing this in poetry, where can we be doing it? And I think it's important for us to be doing it, even if the dominant narratives right now are looking for more sustained kind of engaged action, complexity and determinacy be damned. And I think that, yeah, those people are not wrong who want that too. You know, there are a lot of things that we should be attending to in our political reality, but for me, the poems are not political. They are something else. It's a different kind of space.
Thank you. Thank you for answering. Maybe would you read another poem for us? And maybe I'll ask you maybe one final question. But we'd love to hear another poem.
Sure. This is just a small sonnet. It's called "Invention of the Afterlife." When his friend's last notes and letters arrived in a envelope, he found more than 100 pages bound simply with a rubber band. For 3 hours, he dragged his mind through the strands of her tight cursive. He was surprised that he recognized almost none of the thoughts and events related there. He had assumed he would gain a clearer vision of her lost interior, but in the end, so little was revealed. He decided the reading had barely counted even as reading. It was more like combing her hair.
There's a couple of sonnets throughout, I think, in different forms, aren't there?
I think there are two. Yeah.
There are two. There's one in couplets, I think, or maybe.
I think there is a third. Yeah.
Well, I was thinking of it, thinking of that one as a sonnet, but maybe it doesn't. Because I think it starts with a single line, a couple of couplets, and a final single line, maybe.
Mm-hmm. I have to go back and look. I don't actually have the book yet. It's supposed to be delivered today, so I'm just so I can't just flip through it and look.
Is that something, have you been, you know, have you noticed any particular tendencies over the last little while? I mean, I guess this book must have been almost finished, I suppose, by the time our present predicament, to put it mildly, started. I mean, have there been any tendencies towards certain kinds of writing, certain kinds of formal decisions? Is that something you've noticed changing anytime lately?
I don't think that my formal impulses have changed all that much in this book. I think they changed in post. And I think this book is similar in sort of form and structure to post. So in both of those books, you have poems that are in sections, you have poems that are longer and a little more narrative, but not in sections. And then you have sort of shorter lyrics that tend to have some sort of formal element. But I'm trying to sort of complicate the form just a little bit, come up with some way to make it a little bit my own. Not that I'm certainly inventing the sonnet, but I'm giving myself a lot of leeway to not write a perfect Petrarchan sonnet or a perfect Shakespearean sonnet or something like that, to make a sonnet that is very loose. And that does have rhyme, but the rhyme is loose and something I'm playing around with. So I think it's kind of an extension of the last book in the way of writing these kinds of poems that are different enough from each other, but maybe thematically connected, that they feel like there's some range in what you're encountering in the book, even as the book is focused on recurrent ideas, if that makes sense.
It does. And maybe just one other thought. So you were in Belfast. I remember very happily as a distinguished Fulbright scholar in 2013. You're, may I assure you, admired totally by everyone you encountered then and other people too. And Kieran Carson was one of those people, and we miss him, of course. I'm sure. You miss him too. And you published a wonderful essay very recently on his belief in the small back room, where ordinarily Rachel and I produce this podcast. We look forward to getting back to that small back room. But you described that phenomenon as the small back room as places of intimacy, creativity, and negative capability, places where artists forge their ideas, where writers make their work, and where friendship and love, artistic and not, are built. Do you have a version of that? The small back room?
Yeah, I think all writers do, at least that I'm aware of, whether that's a small group of friends or several groups of friends, or, we can certainly have multiple small back rooms. I will say, I remember when Kieran mentioned to me or said to me, asserted to me his idea that he said, Wayne, everything happens in a small back room. And I remember we had just left Molly's yard and we're walking down Botanic on the way to my reading that I had to give at the, that I happily gave, but had to give to, as a part of the Fulbright at the Crescent Arts Center. And I had the reaction that some people had when this essay came out, which was an immediate response of saying, well, but small back rooms are bad. They're like secret places where bad things happen. And then I didn't say that to Kieran. I just sort of nodded. And then by the time we reached the Crescent Arts Center, the whole idea had sort of reconfigured in my head. And I realized sort of how right he was and how wonderfully simple that articulation was. Absolutely. Right. For me, which is to say that, I thought Kieran was, brilliant, not just on the page, but also in person, which was part of the fun of spending, the small amount of time that I did with him. But I also, when I was writing this essay, I was thinking about during the pandemic, where have I spent my time? And I've certainly used more social media than I would normally do, because I've been isolated in my house. And as much as I love my family, we can only say so many things to each other before we need to go to our separate rooms and have 10 minutes to ourselves. But my sense was that work on social media, that sort of posting and talking back and forth and maybe emailing people on social media was not nearly as valuable as a standing Zoom cocktail I had once a week with my friends, Michael Bizet and Chris Santiago, both of whom are poets, terrific poets. We set this up a little bit randomly. It just sort of happened. Mike and I had talked about it, and then I had to talk to Chris about something, and I mentioned that Mike and I were thinking about doing this, and he came along, and it became a regular thing. Every, I think it was every Tuesday, maybe it was every Thursday, we would have, you know, 2 hours of cocktails staring at the Zoom window. And that just was one of the more important things that happened for me in terms of getting through a very long summer. And then also simply the conversations we had about poetry, talking about whatever was happening in the poetry world at the time, talking about poems we'd read, poets we were reading. I think because small back rooms were easier to navigate pre-COVID, they to me seemed a little bit more just transparent and easy and not something I had to think that much about. But having to set up a real kind of Zoom small back room independent of the conversations that were happening in the other more public spaces where poets were interacting with each other really made it clear to me how essential that space was. So I have several small back rooms. I mean, I would say that as I mentioned to you before we started recording, my friend Kevin Prufer, who is an extraordinary poet, you know, we have been swapping poems for 15 years. That's maybe my most essential small back room. But then Mike Bizette and Chris Santiago this summer were really essential to me and helped to get me thinking about the value of that space.
Perhaps as a final salute, and thank you, Wayne, for talking with me. I'm always delighted to speak to you, and especially on the occasion of the publication of this book, which, yeah, it's a marvelous, marvelous book. But as a perhaps as a farewell, do you have a cocktail recipe you would recommend to our listeners?
Well, for me, the my favorite cocktail is the Negroni, which is the easiest cocktail to make in the world. It's just equal parts gin, Campari, and sweet vermouth.
I think that's excellent advice. Thank you very much, Wayne, for sharing your thoughts and poems with us.
Thank you, Stephen. I really appreciate it.
The Seamusini Center podcast is created in a small back room by Stephen Sexton and Rachel Brown. It was produced and featured original music by Connor McCafferty, with theme music by Nick Boyle. With thanks as always to our guest writers and to Connor and Nick for their music.